is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University. I'm initiating an oral history interview with Dr. Jim Evans, a veteran of the U.S. Army. Today's date is the 12th of April, 2004. I am in the interview room on the campus of Texas Tech in the Special Collections Building, and Dr. Evans is in Dallas. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
I'd first like to get some basic biographical data from you. Can you tell me where you were born and when?
I was born in Fort Worth, Texas, 11/23/43.
And do you have siblings, Jim?
I have a younger brother, David, who's 4 years younger.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about your parents. First of all, your dad. What was his name, and what did he do?
Father was Floyd Lewis Evans. He was an accountant in Fort Worth. He managed a small office building.
Mm-hmm. And he had been an accountant all his life. How had he trained for that?
He did not have a complete high school education, and he was educated in Fort Worth in night school.
Mm-hmm.
And he started about 1920 as an office boy. Went to a variety of schools, business schools in Fort Worth, and eventually became an auditor and an accountant.
So he was a self-made man, is that fair?
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
He grew up on a farm, and although he never said it, always said his motto was, "I will never go back to the farm."
Really? Where was he born?
He was born just west of Hillsboro in Hill County, Texas.
Okay. Uh-huh. And what about your mother? What was her name?
Her name was Celestine Nora Wansley. She was born in Lindale, West County, Texas.
Into what kind of family was she born?
It was like a rural family, but her father and family moved to Fort Worth about 1920.
Mm-hmm.
Her father was a mechanic who worked for Texas Power and Light Company.
What about her mother?
Her mother was a housewife, mm-hmm. was born in Pittsburgh, Camp County, Texas.
Mm-hmm. And did your mother work outside the home at all?
My mother had 2 years of college. She had worked before she and Dad got married. Briefly, she had a business she tried to start in the early 1950s of infant and children's apparel, but it lasted probably a year or two at most.
Mm-hmm. And was that in Fort Worth?
In Fort Worth.
Uh-huh. Was there any military experience to speak of on either side of your family?
My father did not serve in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
The story was that he was too old, he had a family, and he was in a critical business. He was involved also in oil and gas business.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. However, I'm not sure about that. I'm rather suspicious because I have an article that said he had a very low draft number. So, I'm not sure what went on with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because my family, they basically didn't talk about much of anything.
Okay. Right.
And I had one uncle, my father's brother, was in the U.S. Cavalry in the 1930s.
Do you know much about that service?
No. That's all I know.
Okay. Now, I know that you're, I know from speaking with you earlier that you're a genealogist.
Yes.
Is there military service further back in the line at all, on either side?
The Civil War.
Sure. Uh-huh. What states?
Predominantly from the South, Georgia, Texas.
Mm-hmm. But none of that kind of came down to you through your own family's oral traditions.
No.
Okay. Now, Jim, tell me about your early schooling. Did you attend public schools in Fort Worth?
I attended public schools in Fort Worth. I lived in the Riverside area of Fort Worth, and so I went, started public schools after kindergarten, and know, a lot of the people I was with for 12 years.
Okay. What kind of a neighborhood is Riverside? Or was it at that time, I should
say? I lived actually in part of what was called Oakhurst, and it was like middle class. Everybody pretty much was the same. You know, like, and nobody had a lot. I mean, there were a few families that were very wealthy, but very, very few.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was pretty average. Most of the parents did not have a college education.
Mm-hmm. Was it exclusively white?
It was, yes, it was white.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at first I was sort of thinking about the neighborhood, you know, that it was, you know, very somewhat traditional, but, you know, what I also realized, there were a lot of immigrants, you know, in the area, because, like, there was Mrs. Gibb, who lived across the street, who was from Germany. She was the grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And down the street, there was Mrs. Koski, who was from Finland. And then around the corner, there was four or five families that we knew as the Greeks. There were farmers, like truck farming.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
In the Trent River bottomland.
Mm-hmm. What kind of agriculture crops were out there, just for someone who's not familiar with the area?
Things like lettuce, tomatoes.
Okay. Were there tensions? Do you remember around people who were different, kids of immigrants, or was it kind of more a melting pot sort of area?
It was pretty much a melting pot. I think the Greek family was named like Bartow.
Okay.
Or Bartow.
Uh-huh.
And we very rarely saw them. I mean, they were sort of, they were on a side street that was a dead end, and they didn't, you know, those children didn't play with the rest of the neighborhood, but I didn't feel any particular tension about that.
Were there religious differences? Maybe some people were Catholic or Eastern Orthodox, or could you tell?
The Bartos, I really don't know, but the Harrisons lived across the street were Roman Catholic, the Gibbs were Roman Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
My family was Presbyterian.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really not an issue.
Okay. Did you go to church as a kid?
I went to the First Presbyterian Church in Fort Worth.
Okay. That was something that your parents did as well?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me about the public schools. Did the school have a name that you attended?
Elementary school was Oakhurst.
Mm-hmm.
The junior high was Riverside Junior High. And the high school was Amon Carter Riverside.
What kind of a student were you, Jim?
Probably A minus.
Okay. Were the studies easy for you, and were there certain subjects you liked particularly?
I studied, but, you know, I did very well in virtually everything.
Uh-huh.
So, but it was probably relatively easy, looking back.
Yeah. Were your parents encouraging of your academic work, or did they kind of take it in stride?
The way it worked out was, I mean, they didn't particularly have to encourage me because I just always did what I had to do.
Okay,
My brother was not, I mean, he was probably just average. And I really sort of felt like I was, didn't want me to shine because it would embarrass my brother.
I see. Mm-hmm.
So that was always sort of a subtext of, part of the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Did your brother actually feel embarrassed, or did you guys kind of work that out as you got toward high school? Or?
Well, I think he was subject to a lot of comparison.
Okay.
You know, I had done very well, and he was struggling.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, that there was a certain amount of tension, and we, you know, were never very close, and mm-hmm. still aren't.
Really?
In fact, I have, you know, finally just had to sort of divorce my family because they were not emotionally supportive
uh-huh.
in different ways.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, that was a very hard decision to make, but actually I'm very happy that I did it.
At what point did you kind of take that decision?
About 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay. Jim, did you participate in extracurriculars at school, say high school, like student government or sports or debate, or was there anything like that for you there?
I was in the band, played clarinet.
Okay, uh-huh. Were you in the band all 4 years?
Yes.
Okay. And so you went to, I presume, football games and all that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was band like a specific group? I know at my high school, you know, the band people kind of hung together. Was that sort of your social group as well?
I was probably closer to people who were not in the band.
Really? Okay. Were you always anticipating that you would go to college?
Yes.
Okay. Did your parents play a role in that, or again, was that kind of under your own steam, you were thinking of that?
Well, I was determined to get away.
Okay.
In
uh-huh.
the sense of succeed emotionally and professionally.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, they were very encouraging, I think, about college and medical school. And, you know, they certainly, you know, they paid for all my expenses.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, Jim, where did you actually go, and why did you choose to go there? This is as an undergraduate.
Well, I had planned to go to Rice.
Rice, uh-huh.
But I did not get in with the first round of acceptance.
Okay.
And one of my father's friends had graduated the first, you know, class at Rice.
Uh-huh.
And I think he intervened. But I decided I really didn't want to go there. And one of my classmates wrote in my annual, you know, he was the son of a state senator. He said, all you have to do to get in Rice is pull. Well, he got in and I didn't.
Okay.
And I thought, I don't want to go there.
Because of that kind of attitude or climate?
That, and, mm-hmm. you know, actually, people I met from Rice, I'm very glad I didn't go.
Okay.
I went to TCU.
Uh-huh.
I really feel like I got a superb education there. Classes were small. The professors were excellent. And I graduated in 3 years.
Okay. I should just clarify the year of your high school graduation.
1961.
Okay. And what high school did you graduate from?
Amon Carter, Riverside.
Okay. And you graduated from TCU then in 1964. Is that
yes.
correct? And what was your major?
It was called Combined Science.
Mm-hmm. Was that
basically,
a pre-med?
Basically pre-med.
Okay.
And actually, no, let's back up.
Sure.
I have my major was psychology.
Okay.
The minor was like combined science. It was, you know, chemistry, biology, physics.
Okay. So you were a psych major?
Correct.
Okay. Did you have it in your mind that you wanted to get into medical school?
In the sixth grade, I wrote that I wanted to be a scientist.
Okay, uh-huh.
But by high school, I realized I wanted to go to medical school.
What clarified things for you along that line?
Well, I think one of the reasons I wanted to go to medical school is like, you know, the scientific interest and seeking explanations.
Okay.
Being helpful.
Mm-hmm. Was there, so it was sort of internally driven reasons
right.
rather than, you know, I could make a good living or that sort of thing?
Well, that was part of it. My parents certainly emphasized being practical.
Sure, okay. Uh-huh.
I always painted, but they didn't really encourage me to do that.
To to be an artist or to pursue that professionally?
No, because it wasn't practical.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And I think they're right. But
right.
But I've certainly been able to pursue that on the side.
And I want to talk to you about the artistic piece of who you are and that sort of element a little bit later on,
okay.
If you're okay with that.
Sure.
Jim, tell me about TCU at the time you were there in the early 60s. How big was the school, and what was the tenor of the curriculum that you encountered, and what went on campus? Can you remember any of those things?
The school at the time probably was like 7,000 people. I mean, it was not that large.
Mm-hmm.
And classes were fairly small. It was pretty homogenous.
Okay.
In the sense of, our backgrounds were pretty much the same. There were, I don't remember any African Americans. There were a few Hispanics.
Mm-hmm.
I was not in a fraternity, so I was not involved in that.
Okay. Would it be fair to say that you were pretty much flat out pursuing the curriculum and working toward that early graduation?
Right.
Okay.
And it partially just sort of happened because I didn't listen to my counselors.
Okay. What did they say that you didn't listen to?
Well, I mean, they actually didn't read the catalog.
Uh-huh.
And they were making recommendations, and I read the catalog, and I knew what I had to do, to get through. And when I couldn't get summer jobs, then my parents said, well, go to school.
Okay, so you stayed in during one or two summers, or?
It was like 3 summers.
Okay.
I started immediately after graduation from high school.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So you started in the summer term of 61?
61.
Okay, So there wasn't a lot of, there was not a lot of time elapsed between graduating high school and beginning college then for you?
No.
Okay. And were you able to get through college then without taking on sideline employment?
I did work probably beginning my second year at Cook's Children's Medical Hospital.
And this is when you worked in the laboratory?
Worked in the laboratory.
Okay. Can you talk about what you did?
Did finger sticks or venipunctures. Did complete blood counts.
So like med tech?
EKG, med tech, right.
Did you enjoy doing that?
Yeah, it was good. Sort of the practical, you're getting some practical experience and seeing what part of medicine was like.
Sure, yeah. How did you come by that position?
I think it was probably through Dr. May Owen, who was a pathologist with Terrell Laboratories, and Terrell Laboratories ran the lab at Cook's Children's.
Okay.
She was very supportive of people who want to go to medical school. She was probably one of our very early women graduates from medical school.
Where had she gone? Do you know?
I'm not sure. Probably Galveston.
Okay, sure.
And she was, just very supportive of anyone who wanted to go.
Was she on the faculty at TCU as well?
No.
Okay, how did you meet her?
Probably through, my father knew Dr. Bradshaw, who was head of public health in Tarrant County.
Okay.
That may have been the way I got to Terrell's Laboratories. I'm not exactly sure of the connection.
Okay.
But she wrote letters of recommendation for people in college. I suspect she probably supported people financially.
Really?
She lived very frugally, and she, lived in the Blackstone Hotel in Fort Worth, and just had a few dresses, and she worked until she was like 98.
She sounds like a very, very interesting character.
I think she was.
Okay. Huh. How do you spell her last name, Jim? Do you remember?
O-W-E-N.
Okay.
The Tarrant County Community College District, there's a building in downtown Fort Worth that's named after her.
Really? Okay. That's interesting, too. Yeah. Would you classify her as a mentor of yours, or was she sort of more generally available to a lot of people?
I think she's more generally available to a lot of people.
Okay. Uh-huh. Did you spend much time with her?
Not that much.
Okay. But she was a figure. She was...
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, I think if there had been a... If I had a need, I mean, she certainly would have been there.
That's a good feeling, too, even if you never have to call on it. Jim, during the time that you were an undergraduate, the president was assassinated here in Texas. I wonder if you recall that.
It was like Friday.
Yes.
And I had finished the lab. My father picked me up at 1 at TCU because I was going to work at Cook's Children's.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, the president's been shot in Dallas. And, you know, it was really stunning. But the thing is, this was my third year of college.
Yes.
And the next day, I had my medical school interview at Southwestern in Dallas.
Oh, gee. Really?
So I came over here. The medical school was pretty much closed down. Parkland was pretty much roped off.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of, you know, they didn't want people just wandering around over there. So, I mean, it was very immediate because, you know, being here in Texas, but then a year, you know, the next day, here I am in Dallas at Parkland Hospital.
With business to attend to of your own.
Yes.
So can you describe, did you actually drive up to Parkland to see if you could get into where you needed to be?
No.
They wouldn't let you that close.
No, I drove up to the medical school.
Sure, uh-huh.
That's where the interviews were going on.
Okay, now, spatially, where was the school in relationship to the hospital?
Well, it's, you know, it's kind of block, and
mm-hmm.
it's basically one building.
Right.
Uh-huh. I mean, there are several buildings that have been, you know, that are interconnected. And what I remember is that we had lunch with Dr. Gregory, who is a orthopedic surgeon who looked after John Connolly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you remember much about that lunch?
And it was very matter of fact, and that, you know, he did, Dr. Gregory didn't say, as a member, much about it.
Uh-huh.
And yes, that's sort of strange what you remember. Like,
sure.
We had blueberry muffins.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. And your dad was accompanying you, is that right?
I drove over to Dallas myself.
Okay, so you were on your own.
Yeah, Bonnie. He picked, I think, you know, he picked me up at TCU
uh-huh.
on Friday, the 22nd.
Did you notice, as you were, I don't know, trying to find a place to park or walking to the school from your car, did you notice security around? Could you tell there was something had gone on? Was it still kind of a heightened sense of, you know, if you want, drama or upset in the vicinity of the hospital?
Not really.
Okay.
I think if, you know, because of the medical school was pretty much closed down, so the parking lots were pretty widely open.
Okay.
I'm sure if you're trying to get to the parking lots have been a very different situation.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But I know they told us, you know, normally we would take you through some of the, you know, medical floors in Parkland. However, because of what's happened, it's off limits today.
Were there people, to your recollection, kind of just milling around and almost sort of memorializing what had happened the day before, or did you not see anything like that?
I didn't see anything like that.
Okay. Where did you go after your meeting with Dr. Gregory?
I think with that, the interviews were over, and that was the end of the day.
Did this congruence of events kind of shake you up a bit, Jim, or did you?
Oh, I was, you know, crying that on the 22nd. No, I was very upset.
Did you have a political or personal affinity to the president? Did you feel
no.
like there was? How did you feel? You said you were upset.
Well, you know, I just thought it was an incredible tragedy of the president being killed.
Mm-hmm.
And probably as much as anything, at the time I was a Republican, so, you know, I think I liked him personally,
uh-huh.
the way he appeared to be. But maybe politically, it was not where I was.
Right, right. Did you in the end choose to attend Southwestern?
Yes.
Or did they choose you, or
well, no,
how
I,
did it work?
I was accepted at Galveston also.
Uh-huh.
And I think I ended up just going to Southwestern because it's closer to home.
Mm-hmm.
It was not an easy decision because either one I could have got into, and I got small scholarships at both places.
Mm-hmm. Was there any curricular preference that you had, any dimensions to the program that were special at Southwestern?
Actually, at that time, the medical schools were pretty much the same.
Okay. What about the faculty? Any particular persons there that you were interested in working with or that you knew about?
No.
Okay. So what really then did govern your decision? Was it location?
It was probably just location as much as anything.
Okay. Did it turn out to be a good decision for you, Jim?
Yeah, I think I got a superb education. But my initial impression was that Galveston was a much warmer place. I think it's in sense of emotionally, because
mm-hmm.
people had a sense of community down there. They were on the island. And the fraternity houses and places to stay were very close to the medical school and the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And in Dallas, that was absent. But, that's also somewhat retrospectively looking
sure.
at it.
Okay. Uh-huh. Right, and Southwestern is, basically downtown Dallas.
Correct.
In a big urban setting, and so in that way different from obviously what you described for Galveston. But did the urban setting suit you at the time?
It seemed fine.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in a fraternity house in the Oaklawn area,
mm-hmm.
so it was within 15 or 20 minutes to the medical school.
Did you drive back and forth? Or
oh
did,
yes.
Okay. And was there special arrangements for students to park and so forth? Or did you?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me about the fraternity house. What fraternity was it?
It was like Theta Kappa Phi.
And was that just the most convenient place to live as a student, or did you choose that specifically?
I think I liked the people who were in it. I mean, this was on Holland Avenue, about two blocks off Oak Lawn. There were, two other fraternities on that same street, same block.
Mm-hmm.
Theta Kappa Phi had, probably more housing on the side, and it was like $20 or $25 a month.
Wow.
Yes.
Did you have expenses aside from your normal living expenses and the tuition and fees, were there also laboratory fees and other things like that that you had to make, and how expensive were your books? Do you remember that being a problem managing the...
No, the tuition was like $400.
Wow. That's just unbelievable now.
Yeah, it really is.
Uh-huh.
And, there have been some lab fees,
mm-hmm.
but, the books were expensive, but at least for the, first few years at least, we were using general medical text, so they were not nearly as expensive as they, during residency.
Sure. Yeah, that becomes a different
yes.
a different order of magnitude. Can you outline for someone who's not familiar with the sort of curricular development of medical school education at that time, sort of first year, second year, third year, how the courses were kind of organized?
The first year, whole year, we had gross anatomy, which is very well named.
Okay, yes.
Because we had to dissect a human cadaver.
Yes.
There was neuroanatomy, and the basic purpose of that, I think, was to create a hurdle so that some people wouldn't make it.
Okay, so what might be thought of as a weeding out class?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And did it serve that purpose well?
Yes.
Okay, uh-huh.
Physiology, biochemistry, and second year we began getting into, methods of diagnosis, internal medicine. It's sort of hard to remember at this point.
That's okay. Just whatever you can recall that is helpful.
And then third and fourth years, we began clinical rotation. Some of them were at Parkland. I was at Presbyterian. That's not Presbyterian, but Baylor Hospital and St. Paul Hospital in Dallas.
Did you do especially well in the coursework, in the classroom work, or did you do better on rotations and clinical work, or were both pretty good for you?
I think did very well because I graduated like number 10 in my class.
Okay, well that's pretty good. were there things about the education itself that particularly you enjoyed?
I found it very hard, but I think like everybody found it to be hard.
Yes.
And partly because most of us were somewhat perfectionists. And there's always this fear of failure, and the professors certainly didn't do very much to encourage you.
Okay.
I do remember one pediatrician who was from Germany, and he was sort of a very jovial man, and if you got something right, he'd go, yeah, yeah, yeah. And, he was wonderful because he was a bookseller, because, he took pleasure in learning. And that's, I guess, what I really found frustrating with medical school was that in college, the professors were very pleased when you learned something.
Sure. Uh-huh.
And in medical school, it was like their goal, at least at Southwestern, was to trip you up.
Mm-hmm.
And, which I found... I didn't particularly care for that educational approach.
Mm-hmm.
That in medicine, yes, you need to learn, and you need to learn very carefully, but you also need to be encouraged.
Was there anyone who emerged on the faculty as a mentor of yours?
Not really.
Really? That's interesting. Jim, what year did you take your MD?
1968.
At what point in the year? Do you remember?
June the 3rd, I think.
Okay. By that time, of course, as I'm sure you were aware at the time, Dr. King had been assassinated. Do you recall that?
I remember that, and I think about the same time, just after that, I had seen Gone with the Wind again. I was thinking how, inappropriate it was. Mm. What we now call politically incorrect.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But you were aware of that at that time?
Yes.
That's interesting.
And also, during medical school, like in microbiology, parasitology, they would say, or... they talk about things like yellow fever or typhoid fever. You may see this Vietnam, is how they said it.
Vietnam.
Uh-huh. And we all laughed because it was going to be over.
That's what you were thinking?
It wouldn't get us. Mm-hmm. Well, this is, you know, 64 to 68.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you how much awareness you had, given, you know, the heavy schedule that you were pursuing and everything else, of how much awareness you had of the American escalation over there, and, you know, were you paying attention to it? Did you see it as anything that was going to impinge on you?
Well, it was certainly in the background for all of us.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was like 67 Israeli war.
Yes.
And then, you know, I think we were there was concern that, you know, medical education might be accelerated to get us out and get us into the armed forces. You know, if that is, you know, something else that develops from that. So, you know, it just, that was all, you know, all these things were brewing.
Mm-hmm. And were you and the other students kind of, did you talk about this? Did you chat about this over coffee or when you're taking a break from studying that, you know, the possibility existed that you might have to go into military service?
Well, you know, when they said about Vietnam, I mean, we all laughed. And we didn't talk about it.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, because, you know, it was going to be over. It wasn't going to get us.
And where did that belief that it was going to be over come from?
Because it seemed like it was just sort of, you know, a sideshow.
Really?
That, I mean, it didn't seem, at least, you know, beginning 64, 65.
Sure, uh-huh.
That much is going to happen. Then we started getting the military buildup.
Yeah. But you guys still sort of felt that it would have to be, there would be a drawdown and an exit before it might touch you?
Well, that's sort of, you know, the way it was presented.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And, but I just remember, like, you know, I had some diary notations that, you know, it was like, I have to go back, but I mean, there's sort of, you know, beginning awareness, and, you know, I remember, you know, like going to an anti-war play, someplace, East Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, you know, the Vietnam protest, and, you know, how upset, like, the Dallas Morning News got about the hippies.
Did you see or know about protests there in Dallas? I mean, were there local protests that you remember hearing about, even if you didn't attend them?
No, but it's like, you know, at least I was aware enough that, you know, I went to this, it was like a small theater that I knew was going to be an anti-war show.
Uh-huh. Do you remember anything about going to that performance?
What I remember was there was a character named Death who was a whore.
Uh-huh.
And she said, "I welcome you with open thighs and a closed heart."
Wow. What did you make of that? I mean, did you have a way of interpreting or a background for all that?
It just felt so real.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. How did it come about that that you actually were drawn to the U.S. Army or drawn toward it, or it sucked you in or whatever? How did it actually happen that you entered the military service?
Well, what was going on was called the Berry Plan, and it was intended to provide positions in the military.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And you might get deferred for residency. You might get deferred for 1 year, or you might have to go in after internship. And, you know, I'm not sure what the process was. It just, I think, was related to what the military, the various services requires. And, you know, you think I sent in a preference for the Air Force. And I got a letter back saying, congratulations, the Army has selected you.
About when did you get that letter? Do you remember?
Probably like 68 or 69. I've got it in some of my files.
Sure, okay.
That I may have sent already. If not, I will.
Okay, yeah, that would be terrific. So you had expressed a preference. You had been given an opportunity to express a preference in some way for the Air Force.
Yes.
Why had you chosen that branch?
Because I figured I wouldn't go to Vietnam.
Really? What made you think that?
Well, just because of, I guess, what I had read and, what I knew about the Air Force is that I would be less likely to get sent to bad places.
Okay. And you have no idea what happened in the interim such that you received this letter from the Army?
No, I think it's, the Army said we need so many physicians.
Uh-huh.
And so they looked at all the graduates, after internship and said, you get this many. The Army gets this many, the Air Force
sure.
gets this many, the Navy gets this many.
And you just happen to be in the group?
I just, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That went to the Army. What happened for you next? Did you have, was there an outline of how you would, enter service, where you had to report, or did that come later?
Well, it was a very gradual process.
Okay.
That began with, when you turned 18 and selected service, you had to register for that.
Okay, yeah.
And then I got like student deferments when I was in college.
Yes.
I was deferred because of medical school. And, as were everybody else in medical school, as long
sure.
as you, didn't flunk out, because, the military wanted physicians.
And your actual transition to basic at Fort Sam in late 1969 came about how, Jim? How did you get a letter saying you have to report at such and such a time, or how did it happen? Do you remember?
Well, it's sort of a series of things. Probably like 68, I was getting, letters saying, you've been selected for the Army. And then you start filling out, forms.
Sure.
That they did, security clearance. I'm just looking at some of the, things and the next thing to go out.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, 28 October 1968, appointment as a first lieutenant.
And they just sent you a letter saying you're now first lieutenant?
Yep.
Okay.
But then it's like all these things you have to fill out.
Yes.
Fill out, where you live, where you were employed. And so the appointment was contingent on security clearance.
Okay. And can you describe that process or anything you remember about it? You had to fill out a bunch of paperwork, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Were you ever interviewed? Did they send anyone
no.
to interview you?
No.
Really? Okay.
No. What I'll be sending is like a copy. Actually, the original of, it was seven different things you had to do in terms of forms to fill out.
Mm-hmm.
It was like 9th of December 1968. Status of registrants, let's see. It was from headquarters, 4th U.S. Army. So, basically, I'm going into the Army.
And are you looking at the documents now, Jim?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm just...
Sure, take your time.
Trying to find what I've got. And because, let's see, 28 October 1968, First Lieutenant Reserve Commission, appointment for an indefinite term.
Uh-huh.
How's that for chilling?
Yeah, that is actually, particularly in 1968.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. At some point, you were told, I'm sure, that you had to report to Fort Sam Houston. Is there any indication in the paperwork you have there, or do you recall them, the Army, taking cognizance of, you know, any further training that you might have signed up for or that you were interested in pursuing?
Well, the options were you either went in after internship or you could do a year of residency afterward.
Okay, and what did but, what did you choose?
I did an internship, and then, you know, I figure they're going to get me one way or the other.
Right, so you did the one-year internship first?
So I just did the internship after medical school.
Okay, and where did you do that?
Methodist Hospital in Dallas.
Okay. And at that point, for someone like myself who isn't really familiar with the course of higher medical education, Are you specializing at that point in the internship?
When I did my internship of 1968-1969, They were all pretty much the same.
Okay.
It was only about the time that you could start doing, like, specialized internships. But what I did was, like, rotations through pediatrics, internal medicine, surgery, OB-GYN, and maybe a few electives.
This is kind of hard to formulate. Were you thinking at that time that your military service was now inevitable? Or were you still thinking that you might, you know, not have to go into service because, you know, Nixon was in office, he was talking about drawing down the number of troops? Did any of that enter your thinking as well?
No, because, I mean, it just felt like, you know, the footsteps of fate, because, I mean, I kept on getting all these things in the mail, because, like, you know, I got a commission as a reserve officer, you know, like 10 January 1969.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, that spring, I remember getting a registered letter that I picked up and, you know, said that I would be inducted in the Army for assignment in Vietnam.
Okay, and it specifically said that?
Yes.
Okay.
And I just remember, I felt like somebody kicked me in the gut. And I remember, I guess maybe in an emergency room rotation, there was a nurse RN named Maggie Klein, who was like a major in Air Force Reserves, and she said, "Oh, it's just fine. You're going in as an officer. There's not anything to worry about." But I don't think she had ever been in a war zone.
Did you ask her?
I don't remember asking. But, I mean, I was just really, you know, you get these orders, and it's stunning, because you realize you're going to get sent to a very bad place.
And her sort of reassurance, although you remember it now, it was sort of cold comfort. It didn't offer you much in the way of reassurance at all.
No, it really didn't.
Were there other people, Jim, who were saying to you, "Oh, don't worry about it. You're gonna be fine. You'll be in the rear areas." Did people say stuff like that to you, or did you not discuss it very much, really?
Well, I think part of it is like, "Oh, you're going in as an officer. You're going in the medical corps, so, you know, you don't have anything to worry about." But, you know, he was basically, you know, in my, like, internship group, they were like 17 or 18. Everybody went in, they either did public health service or they went into the military.
And by going into PHS, did you have a different, was there a different priority assigned to you in terms of potential military service?
That was, you know, considered the equivalent.
Okay. So it was, in a way, a route by which you might avoid going to Vietnam?
Right. But the thing is, I don't think I knew enough at the time to know about it.
How did people find this kind of stuff out? Did you?
I don't know. I mean, there was like two of my people who were in my internship class went to public health service.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm not sure how they found out about it. I'm not sure how they got there.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel frustrated? I remember you saying that you weren't so keen on going to Rice because of the whole idea of pull. Did the same thing kind of operate here for you?
But it's like I felt like I didn't know what my options were or how to explore them. And my parents were always teaching about duty and obligation,
mm-hmm.
and not about questioning.
Okay, right.
Or reviewing. My father was, you know, what I would describe as a totalitarian.
Okay. Uh-huh.
You didn't, I mean.
Just do it.
Yeah, whatever it was, you do it.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't disagree with him because it's, you know, I've called him Stalin because, no, I mean, he was like that.
Right.
That
it's not was, yours to disagree with, in a way?
Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, that's, you know, what I've called the Evans curse, because what I know about my father, my grandfather, and my great-grandfather, they were always very much that way.
Mm-hmm.
Part of my resolve was, I don't want to be like that. And, you know, unfortunately, I see it in my brother that, you know, he's got the Evans curse.
Mm-hmm. Does he recognize that?
No.
Really? That's interesting.
Well, it's a strong history of depression in the family. I've had it.
Mm-hmm.
My brother has it. And, you know, I suspect it's also been an issue with my father,
mm-hmm.
my grandfather. I mean, they were, they tend to be very negative, very consistently.
Yes, and sometimes coping mechanisms are just, you know, just do what you have to do. Do what
right.
you're told.
Yes, and, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. What about your mom? When she found out that you had effectively orders for Vietnam, did she have a particular reaction that you recall?
My parents were just, I guess what I'm, you know, astounded by looking back is their lack of reaction.
Yeah, that is, I mean, that's off, you know, not in the middle of the curve, I would say.
No, and I've got, you know, a lot of letters that I've got from my folks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like they had no clue where I was, and like I was on some picnic. And I was sending photographs back, so it wasn't as if they didn't see where I was.
Well, and also presumably if I have an accurate picture of them, were watching the news. You know, the middle classes watch TV in those years and watch the news, and they knew about the conflict on some level.
Mm-hmm.
Did they ever express a concern to you about your younger brother going to Vietnam? As he would now, at the point where you were about to serve, be certainly in the age group.
Well, what happened with my brother was that, you know, he was not a good student in college.
Okay, where did he go to school?
He went to a variety of schools, like Stephen F. Austin.
Okay.
Uh-huh. I think Texas. He eventually graduated from Texas Wesleyan, but he pretty much flunked out of several schools.
I see. Uh-huh.
And then he got a low draft number, mm-hmm. so he volunteered for the Navy. Probably like 1970.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents did. I mean, they were frustrated that they had two sons who had to serve in the military. when, you know, a lot of families, you know, none of their sons went.
Was that their way of expressing concern, or was that not clear?
They felt it like it wasn't fair.
Oh, okay. But it was less about you and more about them, sounds like. Okay. Okay.
But I remember, you know, when I came back, as my mother said, what about being killed over there? And she said, oh, we've been proud of you.
Wow.
You know, not that we would have been sorry you got killed. We would have been proud of you. Like, you know, that was just, I think it was very much in character.
I see. Well, Jim, you had to report to Fort Sam.
Yes.
And that would have been in the fall of 69?
Right.
Okay.
Originally, I was supposed to report sometime in the summer.
Okay, what happened?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what happened, but they began delaying when I was supposed to report. And eventually, I reported, I think, 17th of September.
Okay. And what was it like to show up at Fort Sam? Do you remember that day?
Well, you know, a friend of mine, medical school, Bill Elkins, had been, and we met and been friends ever since freshman year of medical school, had reported like 2 weeks before I did.
Really? Okay.
So, you know, I had visited with him. I might have even been to San Antonio. Because he was staying at the Villa Fontana that sort of specialized in people who were at Fort Sam Houston on a temporary basis. So you could get like a 2 month lease.
What is Villa Fontana?
It's just an apartment house.
Okay.
But it was off base.
Right. Okay.
And so, you know, I knew part of what to expect just from visiting with Bill.
Sure. So you had kind of a little bit of a preview.
Right.
What actually happened to you when you first sort of crossed the gate on your own and sort of entered into Army life? Do you remember? Were there examinations? Did you have to be processed, quote unquote, get uniforms, all of that?
Well, we had to pass, you know, have a physical examination. That was done Armed Forces and Korean Examining Station in Dallas.
Okay. At what point? Substantially earlier?
Probably like spring of 69.
Okay. So that had already been cleared.
That had already been done.
Sure. Okay.
And the view of the military was that if you can function as a physician, you know, it's virtually impossible to perform the physical.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Uh-huh. Did people try? Do you know?
Not that I know of, but, you know, basically you couldn't flunk the physical.
Okay.
I mean, there was a friend of mine, after I got back from Vietnam, when I was stationed at Sandia Army Base.
Yeah.
Who had, probably like severely dysplastic hip. I mean, he walked with an incredibly bad limp. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't go to Vietnam, but got sent to Korea.
So that wasn't going to be a route out of there.
No.
Even for people who really were in serious difficulty.
Exactly.
Wow. Okay.
You know, if you weren't dying, you were eligible.
How many people were in that basic course that you were in, the student medical company?
I'm guessing there were maybe 60. That included physicians and vets.
Okay. And vets.
Right.
Okay.
You have a photograph of my medical school. That was that class.
Yes.
Which will give you, the number.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so everyone cleared through then to the end. Everyone cleared through basic.
Right.
Okay. And, Jim, tell me a little bit about the instructors and the attitude of the students towards the instructors.
Well, I think the military Army did a very good job of getting us in. It's a slow process. Like the first week, we didn't have uniforms.
Okay.
But we just filled out these forms and filled out these forms and filled out these forms. And then we had to get uniforms. And then beginning the second week, we wore uniforms. We had a probably marched a little bit. And the class is very hostile toward the military, the Army. And we were reminded that we had volunteered.
Right.
And, you know, technically that was right, but we had either you volunteered as an officer or you got drafted as an enlisted man to do the same thing for less pay.
And the what was the source of the hostility? Was it that people didn't essentially believe in the war effort, or was it that they none of them wanted their careers interrupted in this way, or other, were there other elements?
Well, I don't think we believed in the war effort. So it interrupted our careers.
Sure.
And like, the, you know, I think in the case, like the class photo had to be repeated because a number of the guys were shooting the finger at the Army.
Now, was this young men sort of, you know, flipping off authority, or was there something more serious behind it?
I think it's about, first of all, authority.
Okay.
Because physicians tend to be very independent anyway.
Yeah.
But given the situation, it was, you know, in reference to authority, to the military, to the government.
Jim, did they, and by that I mean the instructors, give you an orientation in any way during basic toward the war itself? For example, did they talk about what the basis of U.S. policy in Southeast Asia was?
No.
Did you think that you already knew?
No. You know, it's sort of retrospectively, that's what was so bizarre about it. That, you know, there were some people who were going to be staying stateside.
Sure.
There were some people who were going to Europe. And, you know, my feeling is, you know, what we got was sufficient for stateside or European assignments. But, you know, those of us who were going to Vietnam, you know, we were really not well oriented, I don't think, about what our situation was apt to be like.
So not very much information on big strategy questions, big issues of U.S. involvement?
No, it's like, you know, we were, you know, it's like regardless of the situation, we could practice medicine.
Okay. Did they talk about battle conditions? The types of wounds you might see?
They, you know, did some demonstrations about the wounds we might see.
Okay. And what kinds of things, do you recall that at all?
Well, they did like a demonstration where they had like a, it was like a 2 or 3 gallon can that was filled with very, very thick gelatin.
Okay.
You know, it's like a Knox block.
Sure.
And they had, you know, put like yellow dye on one side, and then they shot an M16 through it.
Okay.
And it just demonstrated, you know, how the wounds were contaminated because the yellow dye went all the way through this block of gelatin.
And what was the, I mean, as a physician, what was the point of them showing you this?
Well, the point was that, you know, with, you know, the wounds we would be seeing, they were going to be contaminated.
Okay.
So, you know, tissues had to be removed that were, you know, had been severely damaged by the concussion of the projectile. Plus, so, you know, you had dead tissue that had to be removed.
Yes.
Plus, you know, you had also, you know, the projectiles had introduced bacteria and junk.
So the training was that you needed to be aware of the bullet track and so forth, having in addition to physical damage caused, the latent possibility of infection.
Oh, definitely.
Sure.
Yeah.
But is that what you remember learning from that demonstration, or did it strike you differently?
No, it was just impressive about you know, the amount of damage that M16 or AK-47 would do.
Right.
And I'd seen a, you know, fair number of patients with severe trauma when I was at Parkland. And probably I was better. I'd seen more than, you know, I suspect some medical students who'd gone maybe to other medical schools.
Mm-hmm.
But it, you know, ended up, it was no preparation for what I eventually saw.
Okay, right. Just as an aside, at Parkland, what kind of trauma had you seen? What is was Parkland then the central trauma hospital for downtown Dallas?
For Dallas County.
For Dallas County. Okay, and what kinds of things had you seen there?
Knife wounds, gunshots, severe injuries from automobile accidents, and severe burns.
Okay, so you had seen quite a bit then already in the way of traumatic and massive damage.
Yes.
Okay. Back to basic and to the curriculum there.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have weapons training, Jim?
We went to Camp Bullis, which is outside of San Antonio. We did like a night, we did a day compass course. We had previous training like with map reading, compass, you know, how to use a compass.
Okay.
And so like on a day course. Then we had a night course.
Uh-huh.
At Camp Bullis.
And how did those go? How did you do with that?
It was fine.
Did you have to work in teams or something?
Yeah, we worked in, you know, small teams.
Sure.
And then we were at a weapons course. We had like M14s, I think.
Okay, right.
And we had one exercise when we were crawling on our stomachs with live fire overhead.
And how did you adjust to this? Did you do well with it and take it in stride, or were you kind of bucking the system a little bit?
Well, it's like, you know, you're on this conveyor belt. It's like,
okay,
you can't get off the conveyor belt.
Uh-huh.
And so, I mean, you know, we all did it. It was not necessarily something we were, you know, it's like they already had us.
Yeah, right.
Didn't get out.
Did they give you any training in escape and evasion?
No.
Okay. Did you have any kinds of orientation about the military structure and the command structure within which you would be operating?
There were some, but I really think they should have been, you know, like for those of us going into Vietnam, I think there should have been a lot more about what was going on, say, at the battalion level.
Okay, why, I mean, again, speaking now in retrospect, probably, what should they have told you, and why do you think so?
Well, I think, like, what is the mission of the battalion? How do you serve the men in the battalion? Because, you know, we got sent to a lot of different units. You might go to an infantry battalion.
Mm-hmm.
I went to an armored battalion, which meant that, you know, we had tanks and armed personnel carriers.
But at basic, you really didn't get a sense of how the units differed and what they were doing and that would affect you?
Not really, because, you know, it's like what I found very frustrating when I was with the armored battalion was that, you know, there was never any articulate, you know, there's never any good articulation of what our strategy was,
mm-hmm.
or an armored battalion. What were we doing? We were at Quang Tri Combat Base and then spent 6 weeks at Charlie 2, so we were right along the DMZ.
Yes.
And, I mean, there was no articulation about what we were doing.
Why do you think that was, in retrospect again? Do you think they just wanted you to, you know, do your job in the OR and do your job on the wards and not pay attention to those other issues?
No, the thing is, I was going to the evening briefings, you know, for the staff of the battalion.
Right, okay, officer-level briefings.
Officer-level briefings.
Yeah.
So, and they were talking about intelligence, what might be happening, possible infiltration, when there were going to be B-52 strikes. But there was no, there was no clear articulation about what we were doing.
While you were in basic, did the instructors have in-country Vietnam experience or not? Do you remember?
I think a few of them did.
Did they bring that to the table?
Not really. I don't remember, like, one evening there was an extra thing we could go to that was, you know, presented by Fulberg, you know, a colonel, full colonel, in the Army Medical Corps. And, you know, he was talking about, well, when he arrived at, somebody met him at the airport and carried his luggage around. Well, he was a colonel.
Yeah.
We were captains.
Right.
And that no one met us at the airport, you know, other than the bus.
Right.
Nobody carried our luggage. And, you know, the feeling we all had was that, you know, he didn't. He was, you know, providing the Army party line.
Yeah.
And he had no concept of what was going on. You know, or he didn't present to us what we would experience.
And is that, in effect, your evaluation of basic, is that you came out of there with no idea what you were actually going, what you then later found to be the truth of being a medical officer in Vietnam?
Well, I think there should have been, you know, if we were going to be sent, those of us who are going to be sent to an active combat situation should have had more information. But we all got the same thing. And as I said, I mean, the information we got was certainly adequate if you stayed in the U.S. and if you went to Europe. But, you know, in our, if you got sent to Vietnam, you're going to be in a combat zone.
How many of the guys in the medical company that you were in, if you have any idea, were actually sent to Vietnam?
I really don't know. The view we all had was that, you know, I mean, you could, you know, go to Europe, you had to give them another year, but the feeling was that you'd probably get sent to Vietnam anyway.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Because the way the military works is that you have to give them an extra year, but there's no warranty.
Right.
So they've got you for 3 years, and they're still going to do with what they want to do.
They can decide at that point.
Exactly.
Down the line that they are going to deploy you to Vietnam.
Yeah. So the feeling was they couldn't be trusted anyway.
Okay. And is that kind of the dynamic that got set up between the military, or I'm sorry, the medical officers and the green machine, if you will, was that there was just no trust there?
Oh, exactly.
Okay. And you already had that feeling at this point?
Right. I think it was, you know, pretty much uniformly.
Okay.
You know, they had us, but, I mean, we couldn't trust whatever was going on.
Yeah. Jim, you mentioned in the material that you provided to us that in San Antonio, in October of 69, while you were at Fort Sam, there was some kind of an anti-Vietnam or moratorium parade of some kind. Do you remember that?
I just remember I've got the article that I saved from San Antonio newspaper.
Really? Okay. Do you have it in hand?
I don't have it right here,
oh, okay.
But I still have it. I've got a whole box of, like, a box of C-ration. It's a C-ration box in Vietnam that's full of clippings.
Really? Okay.
And so I'll be sending that also.
Okay, super. That sounds very interesting.
But you were like, as I remember, like maybe 15,000 protesters in San Antonio.
Which is saying something.
Which is saying something, because, I mean, this is an area, you know, there were like, you know, several, there's the Army base, and there were like two or three large Air Force bases at the time.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Big military town.
It's a big military town. Mm-hmm. So for this to happen in San Antonio was, I think, fairly remarkable.
And, you know, the summer of 69, before you reported to Fort Sam, had also been extremely busy with a number of, you know, huge anti-war protests out west and on the East Coast. And I'm sure you were aware of those.
Yeah.
And the whole climate of frustration and upset. Did some of that feed into your own feelings at the time about military service? Were you also questioning, you know, whether the United States should be there?
I was certainly questioning, because in my diaries of that time, mm-hmm. you know, basically what I wrote was, you know, I plan to serve honorably and professionally, but I don't think it's worthwhile going, because I don't, you know, I think I wrote, I don't think the Vietnamese wish to be saved mm-hmm. or are willing to sacrifice for themselves.
It's interesting that those questions were already, you know, framed in your mind before you even went over there.
And but I also think, like with my classmates, was that we intended to serve professionally and honorably, mm-hmm. you know, to look after patients.
Sure.
We may not agree with, you know, the military, but I think the sense was we're going to do what's appropriate for patients.
You mentioned earlier that in your younger days that you were a Republican. Were you pleased at President Nixon's election in 68 and his coming into office in 69?
I think there was a certain amount of hope. But I remember, like, when Johnson made the announcement on TV that he would not run for re-election.
Yes.
That, I mean, that was absolutely stunning.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because I was, you know, it was just like a routine TV show, and then suddenly at the very end, he drops this bombshell.
And what did you conclude? Did you draw any conclusions from that announcement, or what it might portend for the election and for the war?
Well, I was hopeful that it would make a difference. But, you know, it also made him a lame duck.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. So, and lame duck presidents, not very effectual.
Did you, what appraisal did you have of Robert Kennedy, who came to the fore then very quickly in the spring of 68?
Well, I guess the feeling I had in 68 was there was this, you know, there was hope bubbling around
mm-hmm.
and promise. And then everything turned sour.
What were the catalytic events, Jim?
Well, with, you know, Kennedy's assassination, Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
There was all this violence.
Mm-hmm.
There was hope for change, and then it was like it was being smashed.
Yeah.
Because of the violence.
Yeah. The I don't know if you recall the events in Chicago around the Democratic convention and the arrests. Was that part of that smashing of hope, do you think?
Well, it was sort of like watching a revolution get smashed.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, it was just stunning to watch it happen.
Jim, let's take a minute. Take a break for a minute.
Okay.
Jim, did you have any time on your own between the completion of BASIC at Fort Sam and your deployment to Vietnam?
It was very few days because, you know, maybe like 5 weeks from when they started the classes till it was over. And I drove from San Antonio back to Fort Worth where my folks live. And then by the 23rd or so of October 1969, I was in San Francisco.
Really? Okay.
And reported at Oakland on the 26th.
How long did you stay there? I would gather this is at Travis, is that right?
No, actually,
okay.
The Oakland Army Terminal,
okay.
I mean, it was on the bay in a warehouse district. And it was an incredibly grim place. And so we got uniforms, we got, you know, our names put on the uniforms, packed our luggage, checked our luggage. And then I think we flew out on the 28th.
Do you?
From Travis.
Okay. And do you recall the route by which you got over to Vietnam?
We flew from Travis Air Force Base to Anchorage. Anchorage to Yokota in Japan. Then Japan to Benoit, Vietnam.
Was it a flight that you were able to get off the plane at any of those stations?
We got off at Anchorage. It was like, you know, early morning. And so actually, before you got to Anchorage, I mean, it was daylight, and it was daylight all the way from there to Vietnam.
Really? Okay.
And we got off, I think, at Yokota. You know, I really don't remember. I'm sure we did, but it's like I don't remember it.
Were you on the flight with anyone that you had known from BASIC?
I think Jay Huebner, who was a classmate of mine from medical school, was on the flight. And I think there was probably several other physicians who had been with me at Fort Sam Houston.
Was it a commercial flight that was a charter?
It was World Airways, which is chartered by, I guess, Military Assistance Command Vietnam.
Jim, can you tell me anything about your feelings or your anxieties on that flight?
Well, I remember a lot of it very clearly because, you know, we took off in like 4 o'clock in the morning, and it was very, you know, typical San Francisco Bay. It was foggy. I remember, you know, looking down just after takeoff, like we're flying over parking lots, and there were these pools of yellow light, you know, in the fog, and I was crying.
Yeah.
And I was on leaning against the window, and just, you know, scared. There were a number of infantry people on the flight, and I remember, like, you know, my chances of coming back are really pretty good. Their chances aren't so good. And sort of this awareness, like, you know, concern for them. That, you know, I will probably make it. I will probably come back in one piece. They may not. And what I likened it to was, you know, like guys joking in the locker room. But it was sort of like this forced joking around. And, you know, it was still going on in Anchorage. But, you know, what I realized, I mean, we're joking around, but this is for our lives. And then after we left, got to Japan, left Yokota, like the flight got very, very quiet. Nobody was talking. And, you know, the closer we got, this flight will never end. And then we were parallel to the coast of Vietnam, and there are all these very ominous thunderclouds, you know, thunderstorms.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody is talking. We, the co-pilot, the pilot said, the train. So, we flew over the coastline at the train.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got the flight, I've got the photographs I took from the jet all the way from Japan to Vietnam that are, this next batch coming out. And then we land. And so they open the doors and this intense tropical heat comes in, like Houston.
Right.
And we wait. We wait. Like, what are we waiting for? And then finally we walked off. And, down the, stairs onto the tarmac. And just cheering. And I thought, wow, this is great.
Yeah.
Except then you get closer and hear these guys in the faded jungle fatigues. And what they were saying is fresh meat, fresh meat, fresh meat. Because they're going home.
And they were chanting?
They were chanting.
Uh-huh. And what did you think about that?
Well, it's, it's bad enough being there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have your own men, your own people, chanting this. That, what the hell am I into?
Yeah, that's pretty chilling.
I mean, it was horrifying. That, it should never have been allowed to happen. But I've heard from others that, what happened in this situation happened before.
Mm-hmm. Did you think that this chant and whatever was behind it had come about as a result of whatever these men had experienced, that it was coming from them as having just been through a year of being in Vietnam? I.e., did you attribute it to them having been in Vietnam rather than, just being cruel? I mean, do you see what I'm asking?
I think, they'd been through a year of hell. They were getting out. And that, it's hard to know.
Yeah. But oddly, it was directed at you guys rather than...
It was directed at us.
Yeah.
And
but
so, they had imbibed the poison, and now they were passing it on. I really don't know because I've never talked to anyone,
mm-hmm.
Who was flying out. Because at least, when I came back, we were not near anyone coming in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know whether that changed or what the situation was, but since I flew back out of Cameron Bay.
Okay.
So I don't know, what the situation is, whether that changed or whether they just tried to eventually separate those leaving from those arriving.
In any event, though, it's quite a chilling image.
Oh, yeah. And then you get on a bus.
Uh-huh.
And we're drove from Benoit to Long Bend.
Okay, right.
And there were, the guy driving the bus was just nonchalant, shifting gears. And it's, fascinating. We're going through parts of Saigon. But there's chain link fence on the windows.
Mm-hmm.
They keep grenades out.
Did you know that was the purpose of it? Did they tell you that?
No.
You just kind of had to... You're sitting there wondering, probably, and then figure it out yourself?
Sort of figure it out yourself. And it's like, I was wondering, the driver doesn't have a weapon.
Uh-huh.
This is a war zone. Why doesn't he have a Yeah. M16. Like, you know, this is not, you know, a U.S. city bus route.
Was it a bus like what we might think of as a school bus?
Like a school bus.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was like, it was fascinating looking around, but this is what Vietnam looks like. This is what the people look like.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of people going by on motor scooters, and but it's like, this, you know, just this trying to get this under your belt about where you are and why isn't the driver concerned?
Yeah, it's a strange kind of incongruous sort of image. Was anyone talking on the bus? Do you remember?
No.
Was it full? Was everyone kind of being driven to Long Bend along with you? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. When you arrived at Long Bend, what happened, Jim?
I think the officers, you know, we went to, like, officers BOQ, and they were just, you know, the military construction barracks,
mm-hmm.
you know, wood with corrugated tin roofs, and then we were, you know, but they were saying, well, you know, there have been robberies of people, you know, coming through here, you know, at night,
mm-hmm.
so like the first, you know, I slept with my billfold in my underwear. I'm not sure how well I slept, but,
mm-hmm.
And then we were sent to the MACV buildings. They were like two-story concrete slab, cinder block, you know, typical, you know, Army construction.
Right.
And there's like a very brief interview about who we are, what our, you know, military, our medical background was. And then we got assignments.
Now, was this just, was there just the two of you, or how many people, how many physicians?
There was, like, several physicians.
Okay.
Uh-huh. I don't remember the exact number. But, you know, they didn't, you know, it was just a very perfunctory, hello, you know, give us your orders, and then here are your new orders.
And was your destination already set out in paper before this interview began?
I got it afterward.
Okay.
But I doubt if there was, you know, I wouldn't have been surprised if it had already been done.
Uh-huh.
But so then you, you know, fill out more paperwork. And one thing, I don't know what I've sent already, but I will send, but
mm-hmm.
it's like when you fill out your own ticket, you know, airline ticket. That this is, you know, military flight, and it's a, and there's a map of Vietnam on the front of this ticket.
Uh-huh.
It's like mimeographed. So you fill out Dinh Mua, and then you fill out Quang Tri, but Quang Tri isn't on the map.
Really?
It's furthest north, furthest on the map, the destination, the furthest north is Hue. There's nothing beyond Hue.
Uh-huh.
And, again, we left, like, 3 o'clock in the morning.
And your orders were for Quang Tri?
Well, my, yeah, we had Quang Tri on the ticket, and it said 1st of the 5th Infantry Brigade. And we landed either Kantung or Pleiku at dawn. And I just remember looking out to see that line of the mountain. But I didn't know where I was. And then we took off again. And then finally landed about 10 a.m. in Quang Tri.
Now, were these planes, I'm taking it, that you were traveling in even all the way to Quang Tri?
Yes.
Okay.
I think they were like C-130s.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So landed at Quang Tri, you know. Then the bus took us to, I think, 75th Replacement Company and Camp Red Devil, Quang Tri Combat Base.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very appropriate because, you know, here I am at Camp Red Devil and it's Halloween.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a little bit too much kismet.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Can you describe the camp? How long were you there, first of all?
Oh, probably 2 days at most.
Okay. Do you remember much about it?
Well, I remember the first night, like, you know, trying to sleep and watching through the, you know, a radio antenna with a red light on top of it, watching the light blink on and off.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we got more uniforms, flak jacket, revolver, steel helmet, a whole bunch of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another brief interview. And I think Jay Huebner, as I mentioned, medical school classmate, got sent to the 1st of the 11th Infantry Battalion. And I got sent to the 1st of 77th Armored Battalion.
Now, was did you see Dr. Huebner again?
Never saw him again, no.
Okay. Do you know what happened to him?
No, I don't.
Okay. But you and he parted company at this point, and
yes.
your orders were to go yet further north, is that right?
No, actually, my orders were to go to 1st and 77th Armored Battalion, which at that time was in Quantico.
Okay, so it was right there.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he got sent further north.
Mm, okay.
Because 1st of the 11th was someplace even closer to the DMZ. And maybe that, you know, 1 or 2 days later, then I went to the Armored Battalion.
Jim, tell me about arriving at the battalion headquarters where you would be serving.
Well, I checked in with personnel.
Uh-huh.
I met, it was like an NCO, you know, who checked me in and then took me just across the path, you know, just across, you know, maybe 50 feet.
Sure.
To the battalion aid station, where I met Sergeant Washburn, who was the NCO for medical platoon, and I've met some of the medics. I met the medical specialist for 91 Charlie's, Mark Doom and Jan Goad.
How do you spell those last names?
Mark Doom, D-O-O-M.
Uh-huh.
And Jan, J-A-A-N, last name Goad, G-O-A-D.
Okay.
And I think Lieutenant Sauer, who is Medical Service Corps, was not there. I don't know where he was. He arrived maybe or came back like the next day.
Uh-huh.
The previous battalion surgeon had already left, so I never met him. His name was Light Burn, L-I-G-H-T-B-O-U-R-N-E or B-U-R-N.
Now, had his rotation come up such that he was leaving in good health? Or do you know?
That's as far as I know, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. How many battalion surgeons were there?
There's one for each company. I mean, each battalion, rather.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was with 1st of 77th. There's the 1st of the 11th Infantry. There was 1st of the 61st, which I think was Infantry. There was a medical company in Quantico. It had several positions. It also had laboratory and x-ray equipment.
But administratively, that was separate from you?
That was separate.
You. Okay. Yep.
Right. And it was maybe half mile away.
Uh-huh.
There was the 18th Surgical Hospital, also Quantico Combat Base.
What was, as it evolved, what was your relationship to the surgical hospital?
Actually, I had very little contact.
Okay.
A few times I went over there, but, you know, what I was doing was providing, you know, I did sick call, and it was pretty much, you know, nothing very complicated. That was like the first
The entire
battalion.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And what the brigade did was they rotated battalions to Charlie 2 from Quang Tri, probably about over 6 weeks to 2 months.
Okay.
And I saw a few casualties at Charlie 2. But the way the system worked was that, you know, if there were guys who were hurt out in the field,
mm-hmm.
helicopters picked them up, medevac helicopters, and transferred them from there to the 18th Surgical Hospital, or there was also a naval hospital off the coast. So if there were severe casualties, I didn't see them. You know, I saw a few guys who got hurt when he had block attacks at Charlie 2, but they were minor.
Okay, when you say minor, can you describe severity? Just
like superficial skin wounds,
uh-huh.
you know, nothing deep.
Okay.
You know, just some piece of metal grazed the skin, cut it.
Nothing that is going to keep someone out of the field?
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm. These first couple of months, when you were at Quang Tri and then up at Charlie 2, did you have a feeling that since you weren't seeing really severe battle wounds, that this experience in Vietnam was not really going to be that bad? It was going to be okay, and you were going to be fine.
Well, once you get sort of settled into the routine.
Uh-huh.
While I was at Quang Tri, you know, we didn't, you know, as far as I know, have any mortars or rockets come in.
Okay.
There were several incidents when I was at Charlie 2 when it got probably rockets, but rockets were more like a form of terrorism because these bases were fairly sprawling.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And when they fired rockets, they didn't have any. You know, with no sophisticated systems to aim them. So, you know, most of the time they didn't hit anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of the time there were also no casualties.
Sure. Uh-huh.
But we would, you know, hear like at the briefings there have been some incidents out in the field where there had been, you know, the companies had gotten hit by the NDA. RBC. So, but we didn't see those casualties.
Mm-hmm. Jim, can you tell me a little bit about the personnel complement for the battalion aid station?
There was the Medical Service Corps lieutenant, who was sort of an administrative officer, the non-commissioned officer, named Washburn, and he was, you know, nominally in charge of the medics.
Okay.
There were two 91 Charlies, or medical specialists, who had advanced medical training. And there were, I think, a few medics, but a lot of medics were out in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and a lot of what I was doing was, I was just like, you know, sick call. And it was, you know, people with, you know, earaches, sore throats, colds, jock itch, athlete's foot, heat rash.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a few patients with, you know, fever of unknown origin, which, you know, it just meant they had a high fever, you didn't know what it was. And in that situation, they were sent typically to the B Medical Company because they could do, like, blood smears for malaria.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that was fairly rare.
So your services were sort of available on a walk-in basis. Is that accurate? Is that what sick call really is? People showing up who are who have some kind of illness that they then describe to you, and you do your best to treat them on an outpatient basis?
Yes.
Okay. Can you tell a little bit about the equipment that you had at your disposal? Certainly some things you didn't have, but what did you have?
We didn't have a lot of equipment. I mean, you could do physical diagnosis, and whatever you do to physically evaluate the patient.
Okay.
Then deliberately we did not have other equipment, because if you needed it, then you had to send the patient to the medical company ATM-CERT.
So those more complex things that required some sort of equipment
right.
were handled elsewhere.
We had a refrigerator so we could keep some, like injectables, like penicillin.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a ward where if somebody needed to be observed, we didn't use it that much. I think it had been built when the Marines were there and they were getting casualties and they needed basically mm-hmm. ward space.
Sure.
Actually, the battalion aid station had a lot of room.
Okay.
Because it was designed when the Marines were there when they were getting heavy casualties.
Did you set broken bones at all?
No.
Okay, so anything like that, even from, say, a finger or something like that, would go where?
Okay, if it's like a finger or toe fracture, particularly like toe fracture, what you just do is tape it to the next toe. I mean,
sure.
That's
uh-huh.
what you do here.
Yes, now.
Yeah.
Still what they do. Right.
But for fractures, and they would go to 18 Surgical Hospital.
Okay. Now, Jim, am I right in thinking that you did a number of flights out from Quang Tri and Charlie 2 to other camps during this time period?
Yes.
Okay.
The colonel asked me to go on flights, and he asked, and you said yes.
Sure. Who was the colonel? Do you remember?
When I arrived there, it was Lieutenant Colonel Miller. And he transferred command the 16th of December 1969 to Lieutenant Colonel Baird, B-A-I-R-D.
Okay. And go ahead, Jim.
Okay, and we flew to places like Quaviet, which is a naval harbor on the Quaviet River in the South China Sea, within 2 or 3 miles of the DMZ. I flew to Charlie 2, Alpha 4. I think I flew to Camp Carroll, which is west of Quang Tri.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the earliest flights I made was to My Loc, which was a Special Forces mountain guard camp up in the mountains.
What can you tell me about that camp and that visit?
Well, we flew along the Quang Tri River. I'm not sure that's what the Vietnamese called it, but it was the river that goes through Quang Tri City
uh-huh.
out west.
Sure.
And it's, I've got slides of that flight, and it's incredibly beautiful, very steep mountains covered with, very, very thick jungle, narrow rivers. And then we landed at My Loc, and I just remember it's this sort of green patch in this valley surrounded by concertina.
Mm-hmm.
And, we were there very briefly, but I just remember on the flight out there, if we crash, I am completely lost.
Why?
Well, I don't know how to survive in the jungle. I had
mm-hmm.
no jungle survival training.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where we are. I don't know what to do if a helicopter crashes. This goes back to what I think was a real failure of the U.S. Army, was that they didn't consider where we were being sent to skills we needed, not just to practice medicine.
Sure. Mm-hmm. But in the event that something unplanned happened,
right,
yeah. What were you going to do?
Yeah, because helicopter crashes were not unusual.
That's very true.
Even when they weren't hit
by
fire.
That's very true.
Because I took care of one of my classmates from medical school, James Scribner, and another medical school classmate, Frank Elliott, was in three helicopter crashes over there. So, they were fairly common events.
Jim, what were you supposed to be doing on these flights? And did the colonel, either the first or his replacement later, did these men actually go with you on the same flights?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what were you supposed to be doing?
Part of the time, it was like going to Quavia. There were, companies from the 1st of 77th Armored Battalion out there. This battalion also had an attached cavalry squadron with tanks.
Mm-hmm.
So, to check on the men, to see if they had any medical needs that I needed to address, to check on the medics,
mm-hmm.
see if they had the supplies they needed, whether they were having problems or needed counseling or just to be available for whatever their needs were.
Now, were you able to command a flow of supplies, or could you get that done by reporting to someone who could if there was a shortage?
The Medical Service Corps Lieutenant or the NCO for the platoon would handle that.
Okay, and did that come up at any point, where guys out in the field, the medics, didn't have what they needed?
I think it came up a few times.
Okay.
But it was seemed like a readily addressed.
Sure.
Not a major problem.
Okay. And is it fair to say that you were sort of bringing sick call out to some of these camps? Is that?
I was available if it's needed.
Okay.
But pretty much it wasn't, because if the guys had had anything significant, they got sent to the rear area.
It would have been medevac?
Medevac. A number of these areas, you could, like Minlock, not Minlock, but Quavia, it's a jeep trip. A few times I went on a jeep trip there, between there and Quantry.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Minlock, the only way into Minlock when I was there was flying.
Yeah. Did you, when you were up at Minlock, did you see or work with any Montagnards?
No.
Okay, so you didn't provide any medical services to them?
No, I was only there once.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Were there other things about this particular time period that you recall that you'd like to include?
Well, it's like, we moved from Quang 3 to Charlie 2 in December.
Uh-huh.
And remember, I was there for 6 weeks.
Okay.
So, spent Christmas there, living in a bunker.
Uh-huh.
We had a few casualties, not that many. I was wondered what would happen if we had incoming while I was outside. And the first few times we had incoming, I was in the bunker. And then probably January, I was outside by the mess hall. And I don't remember whether somebody yelled incoming because I could hear it, or what it was, but before I knew it, I was on the ground. I didn't get hit, but I knew what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Not long after we got there, I was called to check on two guys in a truck that had rolled over. And it had rolled down an embankment. It was a very slippery clay. And, they said, well, we want you to go down there and check and see their condition, because if they're alive, we will very carefully, winch the truck up. If they are dead, we won't be quite so careful.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going below the truck, which is very precariously balanced. And I thought, I may get crushed too, but maybe they had been crushed together and suffocated. And like early January, went to UFO show. That was a trolley tube.
Okay.
And they, you know, a gunshot fired, and I was called to see a guy named Sergeant Hall, who'd been killed because somebody's M16 had fired accidentally.
This was at the show? Or
at the show.
Uh-huh.
And I remember, like, going through, you know, his effects and identifying who it was. And, you know, here's a photo of, like, a wife, maybe children.
Uh-huh.
And, like, you know, it's what the military calls friendly fire, but you know, he's still very, very dead.
Did that kind of incident, that and the men who were crushed in the truck accident, did that have lasting effects on you in terms of processing your own experience? Did it bother you?
Well, it's just, you know, the images are very clear.
I'm sure.
The feel is very clear. That, you know, it was just like one more loss, one more loss, one more loss, and for nothing.
Mm-hmm. Jim, can I just ask you a few details about how you were to proceed when you had declared someone dead? I mean, was there a registration process that had to be gone through, and what was that process?
Generally, graves registration took over.
Okay.
In terms of identity and transferring the body and filling out the paperwork.
Now, tell me anything you can about graves registration people. Were those enlisted men?
As far as I know.
Okay.
I didn't have a lot of contact with them.
Okay, uh-huh. And were there certain forms that you had to complete as the physician on hand?
Very, very rarely did I ever have to do it. One time I remember was in October of 70 when there was two helicopters collided near July, and I had to fill out the death certificate. But, you know, I still don't understand in that situation. I mean, they were clearly had died out in the field. And, you know, like in that situation, it was very odd that they were even brought into the emergency room at the 91st Evacuation Hospital.
And that was about the only time you really recalled doing a death certificate?
Yes.
And no real idea as to why that incident was different from others in terms of the paperwork that was required?
I don't know unless it was part of, like, you know, they wanted a physician to, you know, issue the cause of death. The thing about, you know, what happened and, you know, when the guys were brought in from the crash near Chulai, if they wanted sort of a forensic evaluation, I don't know why they didn't contact the pathologist who's on the staff of the hospital.
Were these were the men that we're talking about military? I mean, they weren't civilian.
They were U.S. military, yes.
They were U.S. That's strange. Well, Jim, did you take an R&R break during the time that you were assigned to the 1st of the 77th at all?
Yes. Went on R&R to Hong Kong. It was like late April 1970.
Okay. Tell me what you can about how that trip came to you, how and what your flight pattern was over to Hong Kong.
Flew from Quang Tri to Da Nang.
Okay.
And went through R&R processing, customs, and Da Nang. And I spent probably 1 or 2 days there. I've got pictures of China Beach, the China Beach Officers Club, Freedom Hill, PX, the Freedom Hill USO Club Interior. And then I got to Hong Kong, and I just remembered I was so relieved to be able to lie down on a clean, comfortable bed, not worry about things crashing in the night, having some good food, and just a sense of safety.
Did you choose Hong Kong? Did you have a choice of destination?
I chose Hong Kong.
Okay. Why?
It seemed like it was a cosmopolitan place to go, and you know, in terms of comfort and good hotels and food, and I think probably like curiosity about being so close to China.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I remember I went on like, you know, one of the tourist jaunts that went out to like Chow or something like that. I mean, it overlooked Red China.
Okay.
And it's like, you know, this is beautiful, pastoral scene with all these rice paddies and ducks quacking.
And what? I'm sorry?
Ducks.
Oh,
quacking.
Okay. Oh, really?
And it's like, you know, I never thought in my life I'd see, you know, China.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, here it is, this, you know, little hillside overlooking China. Like, wow. It was sort of just amazing that it would happen.
And I'm sure you took some photographs.
Yes, unfortunately, I no longer have them.
Really? What happened to those?
I threw them away. Well, they were sort of boring.
Okay.
You know, I wish I had them, but in terms of color photographs, I no longer have those. I do have black and white negatives.
Of other parts of that trip?
From Hong Kong.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Now, did you pal up with somebody, or did you kind of spend your R&R on your own?
I think I, you know, the first time I went to Hong Kong, they were with another officer that I knew from Quang Tri.
Mm-hmm.
And he met his wife there, but then I was on my own. So I just did a lot of walking around. I took Star Ferry back and forth between Kowloon and Victoria Island. Got some clothes. And, you know, went to a French restaurant, Au Tru Nomant. And I went back there repeatedly. Been like, it was just good food.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you know, it just felt good. And it was. And then that was during the Cambodian invasion. So I'm reading about that in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm. What did you actually hear about it? Just that it had happened?
And, that it had happened, right.
Uh-huh. And did this cause any anxiety to you?
Well, I figured I was going to get called back from R&R.
Right.
Because I didn't know militarily what it meant in terms of Quang Tri province.
Uh-huh.
Since I was in I Corps, and this was happening in 4 Corps.
Sure, right.
You know, I thought, well, it'd make military sense to do something at the I Corps.
Did you have a view as to whether the United States, you know, openly sending forces into Cambodia was a good idea? Did you think about that bigger question as to whether this was a, you know, a positive development or not?
Well, I think what something, first of all, I don't think we should have been there.
You mean?
In the sense of looking at the history of the area.
You mean we shouldn't have been in Cambodia or?
In Southeast Asia.
Oh, okay. I see. Mm-hmm.
And, but it's like I knew this when I was up in Quang Tri that you know, it was a problem about if we getting permission to fire back.
Right.
That, I mean, you took fire from villages, some of them that had to go through the province chief before you could fire back. So, you know, we were sort of hamstrung about what we could do. And ignoring the Ho Chi Minh Trail that, you know, was only a few miles away, where you have all these munitions of people moving back and forth, and we're not doing anything about it.
And so the Cambodian invasion was just sort of the next kind of step in this, would you say, in this foray into Southeast Asia that was sort of ill-conceived?
Right. It's a sense of, you know, you're going after the tail, why not go after the neck?
Meaning the Ho Chi Minh Trail?
Ho Chi Minh Trail, up near the beginning, rather than, you know, the tail end of it where, you know, the supplies are already down there.
Right.
And why not stop it, or at least do something about it more effectively?
Jim, did you think that at that point the United States might also move into Laos?
I wouldn't have been surprised.
Okay.
The thing is, when the 1st of 77th got back from Charlie 2, we didn't do much of anything. And, I mean, there weren't any rumors, but I thought, my feeling was it was too quiet.
Okay.
That something was brewing.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that after 6 months out in the field, I could transfer to a hospital. So actually, after 7 months, I transferred to 91st Evacuation Hospital. And a few weeks after that, then, you know, the brigade went out to Kaifeng, you know, out west.
Yes. And did that seem to you like it might be preparatory to a move across the border?
It would have made military sense.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they went out there and turned around and came back.
Did you keep up with what the 177 was doing?
Right.
After you left?
We got, you know, the Stars and Stripes.
Sure.
My father, you know, usually sent a lot of clippings.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I would get, you know, he would send clippings from what was going on. That would be like either the Dallas paper or the Fourth newspaper.
Did he send you anything about what happened at Kent State University?
No.
Really?
No.
Did you find out about it some other way?
It's in the news.
Okay. Was it in Stars and Stripes, do you recall?
Probably was.
Uh-huh.
I've been, you know, looking at some of my photographs.
Sure.
And I've got one that I took that shows a headline that said, police kill two students. And I don't know whether that's Kent State or not.
There was another shooting in the South.
Okay, I mean
a couple days later, I think Mississippi State. I could be wrong, but there was a second shooting at a historically black college in
okay,
the South.
Okay, but I don't know
because
actually this date was sort of like February.
Okay.
But you know, I was like when I did scanned it and then blew it up, then I could read part of the
sure.
headline. I thought. Oh, and that was, you know, taken inside the place I lived in Quantry. And
that is amazing, actually.
On the floor, you can see this painting I did that looks like Jackson Pollock. You know, with swirling paint. And, you know, I did two of those paintings, one in Quantry, one in Chulai. And, you know, as much as anything, it sort of captures the swirling chaos that I was in the middle of.
Jim, there's a couple things there that I want to ask you about.
Sure.
First of all, you mentioned that you were able to put in for a transfer to the EVAC hospital after having served a certain amount of time in the field.
Yes.
Was that a like SOP that after having been at the battalion aid, you could ask for and get a placement to a hospital?
Yes.
Was it the sense then that being at battalion aid was because it was more forward, in a forward location, was a more dangerous placement for you?
Oh yeah.
Uh-huh. Can you tell me a little bit about the regs around that, if you remember anything?
We were just told in advance that, you know, if we, you know, after 6 months out in the field, we could request the transfer, you know, back to, you know, a hospital or a rear area.
And could you specify what hospitals or no. Was it? Okay. So you just put in for the transfer and then whatever was needed at the time, that was the space that you might be given.
Yeah. What happened was I went from Quantry to Da Nang, I think it was like the 67th Medical Group, and then they determined where I was going.
I see. And that happened for you in... Am I correct in saying June of 1970?
About the 4th or 5th of June.
Okay. You mentioned that you were doing some painting while you were in Quang Tri. Can you tell me, first of all, how did you get supplies to do that, and what were you painting on?
I was painting on either plywood or masonite.
Really?
And
okay.
I was looking at one of my photographs, and I realized that there was a small building that I thought was an outhouse between the hooch that I lived in at Quang Tri and the aid station.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I realized that wasn't an outhouse. That was where we stored paint.
Where you stored paint?
Yes.
What kind of paint?
Oil paint.
Was it cooler in there, or
I don't know.
Safer, or...?
It may have been safer, you know, as volatile as oil paint.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
But I don't know, because I've got a photograph of Paul Sauer, the Medical Service Corps lieutenant, painting the door of our hooch red. And, you know, look behind him, and here's, you know, a door open. And I realize, oh, that's where we stored paint.
Was the paint that you were using something that was already available kind of on the base or at the battalion headquarters?
Right.
So you were just kind of taking what was already there? Was it something special ordered?
No. It was whatever was in that little supply house.
And, Jim, if you can, just reflect for a minute on what role painting was playing for you at this time. Can you say anything about that?
I just think it was about chaos. I mean, the swirling paint that you've sort of thrown on the canvas. And part of that sort of retrospective, and I think at the time I wasn't particularly, you know, thinking about what it meant. It just... what I wanted to do.
Was it expressing something?
Right. And
outlet? As an outlet?
I think it was an outlet. Because the two sort of artistic outlets I had were photography and, you know, this painting. I didn't do any more paintings, but I was doing a very large amount of photography.
And would it be accurate to say that that you were spending a lot of your free time, your uncommitted time, on the photography?
Right.
Okay.
There was Special Services Club that was, you know, short distance away from the aid station in Quang Tri. So, you know, within a few minutes, you know, very, very short period of time, so I could get there at night. It was air conditioned. They had a very good photographic lab, tons of equipment. I was getting help from Paul Sauer and Jan Goad, who was one of the 91 Charlies.
Yes.
About photography, and it really, I'd always painted since I was a kid. So it was sort of, you know, I knew about composition. I knew about sort of preference for things that I liked and things I didn't like in terms of my composition. Mm-hmm. And also by doing the work in the darkroom, I discovered, like, you know, it's a lot easier to take good negatives rather than to try to correct it in the darkroom.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Had you done much photography before you arrived in Vietnam?
No.
Any?
Virtually none.
Really?
I got a Instamatic camera maybe in 68.
Hmm.
But I realized, you know, I took a, you know, I think the last batch of stuff that I sent to the archive was like 24 rolls of Instamatic slides. But I realized that, you know, I couldn't do with that. I mean, the quality wasn't there for doing prints.
Okay, right.
So then I got a 35mm Canon camera from like February 1970.
Now, how did you get the camera?
FPX.
Okay, uh-huh. And was film a problem?
Nope.
You could get as much as you wanted?
Oh, yes.
Wow. Okay. And so you were, with the help of a couple of friends, you were sort of teaching yourself how to develop and and all that?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And this was providing you with, I don't know, what would you say it provided you with?
Well, it gave me something to do because most of the time I was bored.
Uh-huh, okay.
I didn't like drinking. I do drink some, but it's like, you know, spending a lot of time drinking has never been an interest or doesn't work for me.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So it's what I could do in the evening, at least part of the time. And I realized it, you know, very creative about what I, you know, sort of what I could realize by doing it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And it was documenting what happened, where I was.
Were you aware of that function? I mean, were you conscious of that function of photography at the time, that you wanted to, like, keep a record in some way of what was going on?
I think, first of all, like keeping a record,
uh-huh.
because, and like storytelling, because I mean, there's like a series of calling in a medevac helicopter at Charlie 2.
Uh-huh.
You know, showing the helicopter coming. Well, first of all, there's a Jeep. They have smoke grenade or whatever it is.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like yellow green smoke. They're calling in the chopper, and the chopper's coming in. Chopper is on the landing pad. And then taking off. And then there was another series that I took where I was on top of the medical aid station bunker. And I did after I got my 35mm camera, and I did a 360-degree panoramic view, just turning around to portray the whole area where the battalion was.
That's amazing. And you were thinking of it in terms of storytelling, of getting sequences of things that happened?
I think sequences and
uh-huh.
where I am, what's going on, and I guess learning
uh-huh.
what I'm doing and what's working and what's not working.
And you were doing this for yourself, though, is that right, Jim? You weren't thinking down the line, or were you, about some potential use for this material in the future? Were you doing it for yourself in the moment?
I think it's pretty much in the moment.
Yeah, huh?
Uh-huh. I'd had an interest, like, in genealogy.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Before, but so I really don't think it was that much future-oriented. But, mm-hmm. you know, I felt like, you know, what was going on was different, and I wanted, I guess, that scrapbook of what happened.
Sure, sure. Jim, you also mentioned alcohol use, and I wonder if you can talk about what your observations were at the time as to how much alcohol and drug use played a part in the lives of at least the people that you were around.
There was a lot of drinking.
Mm-hmm.
The Army was obsessed about drug use.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I was oblivious to it, but, you know, I was certainly very aware that the drug of choice and the most obviously abused drug was alcohol.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But the military ignored that. But, you know, maybe I wasn't aware of secondary, you know, other drugs that are being used with the alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly, at least where I was, wasn't evident.
As a physician serving over there, did you ever see a diversion of medical pharmaceuticals?
No, because they were pretty tightly controlled. I mean, we had, when I was at Quang Tri,
uh-huh.
you know, we had to have an audit monthly by someone else who was not part of the medical platoon.
Really? Okay.
And we had very, you know, we did have, you know, like the medics would have injectable morphine,
mm-hmm.
you know, the unit doses. But that was also, you know, they had some out in the field, but they had to account for it. And we kept the rest of it in the safe at the platoon. So, I don't think it had been that easily diverted.
Okay, so the protocols around that were fairly strict?
They were fairly strict, yeah.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Did you see or know about marijuana use or anything harder than that at all?
Well, I heard about it,
uh-huh.
but basically I didn't see it happening. So,
uh-huh. And any of your patients ever come in with symptoms or side effects that you thought might derive from drug use?
One of the medics, you know, I suspect it was probably doing a lot of marijuana,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know. You know, mm-hmm. I never saw him use it.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was at the 91st Evacuation Hospital, we saw a lot of guys who came in who were, you know, out of their heads. But most of those, you know, had been drinking. They may have been doing something else, but primarily they've been drinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very well, I mean, they may have been doing other stuff and they weren't talking about it.
Sure,
but,
sure.
You know, they certainly smelled like they had been drinking.
If I can, I want to ask about another area that... that is, you know, fairly unpleasant, and that has to do with any observations you may have had about racial tensions during the period you were there. 69-70 was one in which certainly there were heightened tensions between African Americans and whites in the States, and to a lesser extent Hispanics and African Americans. I wonder if you saw any incidents that made you sort of sit up and take notice of race relations while you were over there?
One was the way that the military handled a particular dermatitis that African-American men get when they shave closely.
Uh-huh.
And not all get it, but they shave closely. A lot of the beard gets ingrown.
Yes.
Creates bumps.
Sure.
They shave more closely, which then causes bleeding. They get infected. And the military viewpoint was that these men, you know, to defy authority, deliberately developed this dermatitis.
Okay, by doing what? Shaving, pushing the razor down harder or something?
We were supposed to be closely shaven.
Okay, right.
And that for Anglos, you shave closely, then it's usually not a problem.
Uh-huh.
But it was, the view was that, you know, the blacks were doing it as an act of defiance. When, you know, there were some medical facts going on that they were prone to this situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that, so, you know, some of these guys would want to get profiled, which, you know, not to shave closely. And the Army was saying, no, you can't do it because it, you know, will affect discipline in the field.
Did you get this via a briefing or just kind of informal orders?
Basically, we weren't supposed to profile them for this.
Uh-huh.
Unless it was really severe.
Okay, by profiling them, you mean?
Having permission not to shave closely.
I see. Okay.
Or to have like a closely cropped full beard.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I felt like this is pretty much institutionalized prejudice about it.
Yeah. And so how did you handle the situation?
I profiled them as necessary.
Okay.
But, you know, that wasn't popular with the command. I was not, you know, this was never was an act of defiance. Like,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
Did anybody come down on you and say, you know, Evans, you need to toe the line on this issue, or did it kind of get by?
Well, I had comments from the major.
Uh-huh.
Brought the message from brigade. That was part of it. The African Americans tended to, you know, be off themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that was going on. I remember there were quite a few fragging incidents, which I think I've already sent you, in Quang Tri. But one of those, there was an African American man that Captain Osteen, who was head of D Company, had issued a direct order to, and then, you know, Osteen went to arrest him, you know, pulled his revolver, and then the two guys started fighting over the revolver.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually the guy was subdued and arrested. But, you know, I don't know. I think the guy had refused the direct order. But I don't know what the order was about.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what happened? What was the outcome of that exchange?
I assume it's court-martialed, but
mm-hmm.
No, I really don't know specifically.
Sure. Mm-hmm. You said there were quite a few incidents. Do you, how would you hear about them? Was this kind of chatter going on, or as an officer, did you hear more?
First of all, I mean, there was one of the medics named Priest, who was a conscientious objector, who was pulling charge of quarters in the Captain Osteen's office one evening. The medics, among others, were rotating through there at night.
Mm-hmm.
And someone, you know, rolled a grenade in there, into the office, and severely wounded Priest that blew up his guitar. And I've got a picture of the neck of the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was transferred to 18th Surgical Hospital and then out of country. And he blamed me for it happening, that, you know, he shouldn't have been pulling charge of quarters, but, you know, they'd been doing it before I got there at battalion. And the feeling I had was that if they had not been pulling charge of quarters, you know, where they were, they would have been out on the bunker line.
And, Jim, just for reference, can you say what charge of quarters means?
Well, basically just keeping the company commander's office 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it were doing anything, you know, other than you have to have a live, awake body.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In the company commander's office. I don't think it was doing anything.
And how was it that you, I mean, how was it that you were blamed?
Well, Priest felt like that as a medic, he shouldn't have been, shouldn't have had that duty.
I see. Uh-huh.
But they were doing that before I arrived.
Right. It wasn't an innovation that you introduced.
It was not an innovation that I introduced.
Right. Uh-huh.
You know, the feeling I had, as I said, was that, you know, if they had not been there, they could have been out on the bunker line, which should have been far more exposed and worse circumstances.
Was this incident with the grenade ever, to your knowledge, tracked down?
No. I mean, this is typical. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, Paul Sauer told me later that there, you know, someone had put a grenade or Claymore mines or Lieutenant Colonel Baird's hooch in Quantry. This was after, probably like June 70 after I left.
Okay.
There was an attempt to get one of the company commanders who was a West Point graduate. I mean, he was real, you know, sort of hardcore disciplinarian about uniforms and stuff like that that didn't matter.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And it severely wounded him and his executive officer, a first lieutenant.
How were they wounded?
It was, what I heard was like somebody put like a Claymore mine by their hooch and set it off. There was one patient that I saw repeatedly complaining about a bad back.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally sent him to B-Med to get his back x-ray.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw him jump off the back of a 2.5-ton truck, a deuce and a half, which is like 4 to 5 feet onto the ground.
Yes.
With his bad back. And so the x-rays were negative, came back to the aid station, and I told him what I saw. I just happened to see it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And he later assaulted, you know, a company sergeant, first sergeant, out in the field. And the first sergeant decked him, you know, knocked him down, broke one of the vertebrae in his back, so he ended up with a bad back after all.
Mm-hmm. What was the origin of their mixing it up, do you know?
I really don't know.
Okay. Jim, did anybody ever come after you for not having, you know, I don't know, ratified their imaginary illness or something similar?
I received threats that if you don't profile it, get me out of the field, something may happen.
Uh-huh. Was this while you were up at Quantry?
Quantry, yeah.
Uh-huh.
If the guys were really politically knowledgeable, they got a congressional investigation. You know, they would write to the congressman. The congressman would request medical information, and they could get out of the field that way sometimes.
Uh-huh. Did that happen much?
Not that, you know, a few times.
A couple times. Uh-huh.
I think it was not well known that you could do it.
Uh-huh. Jim, what about the can you say anything more about the threats levied at you? Did it shake you up? Did you, you know, just kind of blow it off, or how did it affect you?
Well, no, I was worried because,
sure.
You know, there had already been, there was a fair amount of violence going on against our people.
Yes.
So it was certainly creditable to me. And I was, you know, returning people out to the field, so.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to, or feel like you had to watch your back?
Well, the thing is, when the fraggings occurred, they were usually at night, and, you know, the assailant was never seen.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it was always very anonymous. I think later, to begin, when the guys came in out of the field, they had to turn in their Claymore mines or grenades and live rounds of ammunition. But when I was there, that was not happening.
So people were walking around, or potentially walking around armed.
They were walking around, you know, they were armed.
Sure.
And, you know, where we were, like in Quantry, our hooches were surrounded by sandbags, you know, protect against incoming. But
yes.
So if somebody put a Claymore mine or a grenade on top of it, then it could just blow up this wood building.
Yeah, And you mentioned the two officers who were gravely hurt. Did you have any part in their care?
No.
Okay. Were you able to track what happened to them or keep track of them?
No. What happens is, they were transferred to 18th Surgical Hospital and then went out of country.
Okay.
I do know about that. The captain,
mm-hmm.
who was a West Point graduate, at Thanksgiving 1969, his men were on bunker duty Quantry.
Mm-hmm.
And Lieutenant Colonel, I was with Lieutenant Colonel Miller, and he asked the man, the captain, "Have you gotten a hot Thanksgiving meal to your men?" And the guy said, "No, they're having sea rations." And Lieutenant Colonel Miller said, "You will go to the mess hall right now, and you will make sure that they get a hot Thanksgiving meal out there."
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought, I was very impressed with Colonel Miller for doing that.
For even checking. Uh-huh.
For even checking.
Yeah, yeah.
So, when this guy got fragged lately, later I wasn't surprised either. I mean, mm-hmm. he didn't care enough about his men to get hot meal out to them. And the Army did, like at Thanksgiving and Christmas, you had roast turkey and dressing and cranberry sauce and desserts. I mean, they really did a good job of it.
And was it your sense then that he was, for punishment or somehow deliberately depriving them, the men in the field, of what was available to them in terms of a good meal?
I think it was indifferent.
Indifferent, okay. Uh-huh.
That, just never crossed his mind, they can get by on sea rations. They haven't, all the rest of the time. Why not now?
Was that an index to you? Did you see that in some broader scope? Was an index to you of that man or of something bigger about the conflict?
I think it's sort of lack of basic leadership skills.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was also, transitional view from the past where NCOs or officers could order their men to do something and it would be done, to this 60s,
mm-hmm.
and people are beginning to question.
Yes.
That, if you have a reasonable question, it needs to be answered rather than just giving a direct order.
Right. You have to be able to give some rationale.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I guess one thing that I read recently, there was Westmoreland's autobiography,
mm-hmm.
but he said, he was focused on three things for men: medical care, food, and mail. Beyond the military,
sure.
mission,
uh-huh.
but, part of caregiving was, those three issues. I thought, okay, yeah.
And those were important things for you, is that?
But I think they were important things for,
mm-hmm.
Everybody who was over there.
Mm-hmm. Jim, let's take a break.
Sure.